is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Ms. Norton.
Please be seated. We'll call our second case today, 03-0113, State v. Manuel. Arguing for Mr. Manuel is Stephen D. Phillips, Assistant State Public Defender. Mrs. Phillips.
Stephen Phillips on behalf of Antoine Manuel. This involves the admissibility under the rules of evidence and the confrontation clause of a statement describing a shooting and identifying Mr. Manuel as the shooter made by a witness to that shooting, a man by the name of Derek Stamps, and the statement having been made to his girlfriend hours after the shooting occurred. I would like to begin my argument with the hearsay issue. Naturally, if the court decides that issue in my favor, it need not reach the confrontation clause issue. The relevant hearsay exception is in 908.045 sub 2, the statement of recent perception exception. And the critical language, as far as that exception is concerned, is that the statement be made in good faith, not in contemplation of pending or anticipated litigation in which the declarant is interested. There seems to be three separate components to that language. One, good faith. Two, in contemplation of a litigation. And three, litigation in which the declarant is interested. And I would suggest that the trial court and the court of appeals have thus far focused on only the first of those three components, the good faith aspect. It appears that the courts have been saying, well, the real purpose of Mr. Stamps' statement to his girlfriend was not so much to influence any future litigation, but to convince her to go with him to Sun Prairie to avoid the police. And while I have some argument about that, while I think that his motives weren't exactly that pure, even if the court decides that, yes, that was his principal motivation for making this statement to his girlfriend, that's not the end of the matter. And the Court of Appeals really ignored the rest of the language that I began my argument with, the not in contemplation of pending or anticipated litigation, first of all. It's undisputed that Mr. Stamps knew after he witnessed the shooting in which he had flagged down the victim and had engaged him in conversation seconds before the shooting occurred. It's undisputed that when he eventually made his statement, he knew there would be litigation about this. A shooting results in litigation. And he also knew that because he was not only at the scene, but was the person that actually was responsible for flagging the victim down, that he was going to be interested in that litigation. The cops were going to be looking for him, and in fact, initially he was charged just as Mr. Manuel was. And that would not have been, I'm sure, a surprise to Mr. Stamps that the cops would be looking at him as a potential suspect. So, you know, those two factors are necessary components in addressing the admissibility of the statement under the rules of evidence. And there's good reason for not just focusing on Mr. Stamps' alleged good faith in making the statement to his girlfriend. The simple fact is that when you make a statement in contemplation of litigation in which you're interested, you have it's inherently the situation that you tend to shade the truth. And that's why...
How was this statement, though, in contemplation of litigation?
Because he expected that there would be litigation.
But the statement has to be made in contemplation. Not just that there's contemplation of litigation. The statement has to be made in contemplation of the litigation.
Well, he contemplated that there would be the litigation, and that's what he was telling his girlfriend about, was the fact that he had just witnessed something that he was involved in.
Yeah, well, wasn't he taking his girlfriend? Well, just so it was his girlfriend, but also they had a child. And
yes.
He was concerned about his safety. He wanted to, I thought he, things were kind of hot, and he wanted to get out of the area, and so they went some other place for a while.
Well, of course, it's
I mean, wouldn't it be natural you would tell if he witnessed something, this is sort of an unusual event, he might want to tell somebody about it?
Well, the prosecutor, in fact, in arguing that this was a statement against the penal interest, had specifically argued to the trial court that, in fact, Mr. Stamps was afraid of the police and that he was afraid of what the police would do to him. It's difficult. It's a very difficult task for this court or any court to determine what was in Mr. Stamps' mind when he made the statement, because Mr. Stamps refused to answer any questions about this. Nonetheless, it was the state's burden as the proponent of the evidence to demonstrate that the circumstances surrounding his statement satisfied the hearsay exception.
But could I ask if someone had been standing across the street and knew all the parties involved and witnessed this incident and then went home and told his wife who had fired the shot and then died. Is that a different fact situation?
That's a good example, because I was going to give something very similar to that to explain my position. I think a statement like that would be in contemplation of litigation, but of course the witness who was standing across the street would not consider himself to be interested in that litigation. He wouldn't be a suspect, and he's just an innocent bystander. Another example that I was thinking of is, you know, suppose I get in an auto accident with you, Justice Prosser, and
a bad week.
That would be a bad week, exactly. And I come home and hours after the accident, I tell my wife, well, I got in this accident, but Justice Prosser didn't put his turn signal on and swerved right in front of me before I rear-ended him. In my opinion, that would be, even if I didn't expect my wife to repeat that statement to lawyers or whoever, that would be a statement in contemplation of litigation in which I was interested. And if I died, you know, a week before the trial, and my estate in the lawsuit wanted to introduce that statement, I think you would be very upset about that statement coming in without cross-examination. And that's the situation. Well, obviously, we have a situation in which Mr. Stamps knows that he is interested in the litigation and that there will be litigation.
Counsel, as a follow-up to Justice Prosser's question, one of the concerns I have in your argument is illustrated by his hypothetical. And that is, it seems to me that you define virtually any statement made by a participant or a witness to a crime or a auto accident as being a statement made in contemplation of litigation. And the import of that, of course, is then that the statement may not be introduced because it fails to meet the foundational requirement of recent perception. So you're really broad.
Except that the critical last component of that language is that it's got to be litigation in which the declarant is interested. And that's why the floodgates argument that the Court of Appeals raises in its decision doesn't really apply here. Because Mr. Stamps was not an ordinary witness to this crime. He was not a person standing across the street. He was a person that was involved in putting the victim in the position from which he was shot. And he knew that he was going to be interested in this litigation more so than an ordinary witness would be. And that's why in the typical tort situation that the Court of Appeals raises, you don't have declarants who are interested in litigation making the statement.
But perhaps in the typical criminal case, you do. I don't know how you define in which the declarant was interested. But my off-the-cuff response is most of the criminal cases I read when there are witnesses involved, you know, these are gangs allegedly here, and there are probably a lot of gang members around and a lot of witnesses that I don't know about in this fact situation. I'd say they're all pretty interested. I don't know.
Well, I don't know if they're interested to the degree that Mr. Stamps was.
Oh, no, but now we're talking about degrees of interest. I mean,
Well, I think they have to be interested as a potential party in the litigation.
Where do you get that definition from?
Well, from the top of my head.
Well, a question off the cuff.
Yeah, I think it's implicit in the definition that the rule adopts. But the one thing I want to emphasize about the hearsay rule before I move on to the confrontation clause is that this is an exception that virtually every jurisdiction in the country has rejected. And so it's critical that the court not broaden the exception to such an extent when this rule has been disfavored by virtually everyone who's considered it. And it's critical that the court narrow this exception to the very situation that we were describing before with people who are uninterested in litigation witnessing particular events.
Mr. Phillips, I'm curious as to whether or not you're making the arguments you've been making this morning so that you can make a strong argument that this is testimonial in nature. Is that where you're leading with this? Or are you really just telling us this isn't a recent perception exception situation?
Well, I'm telling you both. It's not a recent perception exception, but if you conclude otherwise, obviously my backup argument is that it also fails to meet the confrontation clause. And I guess, you know, the first issue we would have to look at there is whether the statement is testimonial. And
well, I guess what I'm saying to you is in order to make the argument that the statement is testimonial, don't you have to tie it into the last part of 480452?
You mean that Mr. Stamps was interested in the litigation?
Right.
I don't know if that's necessary. I think
you get it within the idea that it's testimonial.
I think it could be testimonial if it's a statement that he expected to be used for later use in a trial, and that's the definition that I... Now, he wouldn't necessarily have to be interested in order for it to be used. I mean, if for example, one of the persons across the street witnessing this shooting, totally uninterested, maybe somebody just walking his dog down the street, witnesses the shooting, comes home, tells his girlfriend about it, but in a situation where he expects somehow that his statement is going to be used, that would be testimonial, even though it would come in under the hearsay rule, if you follow me, because the person is not interested. But I recommend that the court, and obviously because the U.S. Supreme Court has dodged this issue in defining testimonial, that the court adopt a definition and that it adopt the one that I've just mentioned, whether an objective witness would reasonably believe that the statement would be available for use at a later trial. And that's broader than the examples, although that's one of the formulations that is used in Crawford. That's broader than some of the examples that they give in Crawford of ex parte affidavits, preliminary examinations, government interrogations, and that sort of thing. And while those sorts of evils may have been the principal evil at which the framers of the Constitution were concerned, those are not the only things with which they were concerned. And I think that's borne out by the language in Crawford in which specifically mention that the definition of or the ordinary meaning of testimony is far broader than just, you know, formal examinations and statements. It's actually a solemn declaration or affirmation of something to prove a fact. And that's exactly what Mr. Stamps was doing when he made the statement to his girlfriend. He was proving to her that Mr. Manuel was the shooter.
Is there any evidence that the two men went up to the car to commit a crime? Or any evidence that Mr. Stamps went up to commit a crime?
I guess we'll never know what evidence the police might have had that that would indicate Mr. Stamps' exact role in this and his motives, because he never gave his version beyond the version that he gave to Anna Rhodes. He didn't testify. The charges were dropped. And the record, at least, doesn't reveal why the charges were dropped or what evidence they had that caused them to drop the charges against Mr. Stamps.
Let me give you another hypothetical. You and I go out to lunch together. You see Mr. Weber and suddenly pull a gun and shoot him. And I go back home that night and tell my wife. I mean, I guess I'm contemplating litigation, but I don't expect to be a defendant in it.
Right. A statement like that would probably come in under the hearsay rule, but I would say it should be excluded under the Confrontation Clause. Because a statement like that, when you accuse someone of a crime, you are expecting that accusation to be available for use at a later trial. The police rely on persons coming forward with information like this. This is how the police solve crimes, is people coming forward with, you know, information about what they've heard. And if you consider another example, I guess we're getting into some examples that are a little different than the facts, but I wanted to give one example of why we can't limit the Confrontation Clause to just official interrogations, statements taken by the police and, you know, by the sheriff and so forth, and ex parte affidavits. If they had gone to Derek Stamps, let's say after Crawford came out, and said, look, we know that you were there, we know that you know something about this shooting, and we know that you probably don't want to talk to us, and you probably don't want to testify at trial. That's fine. We don't want to take a statement from you anyway, because under Crawford, if we interrogate you or take a statement, we can't use it against Manuel at trial anyway. So fine. Don't tell us what happened. And if we charge you, and if we try to get you to testify at Manuel's trial, you can go ahead and take the Fifth. But, you know, if you want to tell your side of the story, tell it to your girlfriend or tell it to your best friend, and we'll go interview that person. That's exactly the type of situation that could arise if testimonial is too narrowly defined. And then they get the state can call the girlfriend or friend or whatever to say, yeah, Stamps told me Manuel was the shooter. Stamps never appears at trial, just like was the case here. Jury never sees him. His statement comes in. He's not cross-examined. Presumably, the person gets convicted. And one can only imagine, you know, in this case, fortunately, the shooter or the victim of the shooting lived. But if he had died, Manuel could very possibly have been facing a conviction for first-degree murder in which his only accuser was a person who never appeared in court. And that's what the Confrontation Clause was meant to prevent.
Counsel, you advocate that we take, if you will, the third definition of testimonial set forth in the Crawford case. And as Justice Crooks suggested in his earlier questions, there's a link, at least conceptually, I think, between your argument in contemplation of litigation on the evidentiary issue and whether or not, under your Crawford definition, it would lead an objective witness reasonably to believe the statement would be available at, you said, trial. There's a focus on future litigation in both. Let's say that you say, okay, that's a good definition, but we don't accept that your client meets that definition. Then where do we go in the analysis?
If the statement was not testimonial, then the court has to decide whether the Confrontation Clause even applies to its admission. And the state takes the position that after Crawford, now, if the evidence is non-testimonial, it's just the rules of evidence, you're done. And
they take an alternate position, too, though, don't they?
Well, I mean, they also argue that even if you apply Roberts, it comes in under Roberts. But I guess the first issue for this court to decide is whether there's any constitutional scrutiny at all to non-testimonial evidence. And, you know, it's certainly my position that there has to be, that the rules of evidence were drafted at a time when all hearsay was subjected to some constitutional test. And if you look at the commentary to the rules of evidence, there's always some line in virtually every rule that, where the comments say, well, if there's any problems in admitting this type of evidence against a defendant in a criminal case, that's for resolution under the Confrontation Clause. Well, under the state's position, we're going to eliminate any resolution under the Confrontation Clause. So those rules that were drafted fairly broadly to begin with have now been, with a safety net in mind, the state is now advocating for eliminating that safety net and eliminating any, possible review of the abuses that might occur as a result of the rules of evidence.
Mr. Phillips, would it be a correct observation, and correct me if I'm wrong, that when reviewing Justice Scalia's opinion in Crawford versus Washington, that by his approach of an historical analysis, what Crawford appears to do is to try to go back to a period of law pre-Ohio versus Roberts? Would that be an accurate statement?
Right. I think he goes all the way back to 1790, yeah.
And I guess the reason I'm asking the... Right, Sir Walter Raleigh. I guess the reason I'm asking the question is that, is it also not correct that in pre-Ohio versus Roberts decisions by both this court and the United States Supreme Court, the courts have always held the Confrontation Clause to be something different than the hearsay rules?
Right. Something different, but there has at least been constitutional...
Overlap.
Yes, there's been some overlap, and there's at least been some constitutional scrutiny to the admission of hearsay before Roberts. And, in Crawford, the court was concerned with what it described as the core of the Confrontation Clause. But, they didn't say that testimonial statements themselves were all that the Confrontation Clause was concerned with. And they specifically left that decision unresolved. So, it's a choice between having some constitutional scrutiny and having none at all. And that's why, I don't think we're really arguing over what test ought to be applied if there is constitutional scrutiny, because the state hasn't suggested any other tests, and neither have I. I don't know of any other tests.
Of course, that's left up to the states, is it not?
It is left up to the states. Most of the jurisdictions have decided since Crawford that they will still apply Roberts to non-testimonial hearsay. And the vast majority of them have decided to do that. And I think that's, the correct decision. I guess the state's position comes down to something of a double whammy. You know, first we're going to apply this hearsay exception that virtually nobody else considers to be valid, and then we're going to remove what used to be a safety net from the abuses caused by exceptions like this, and have no further consideration whatsoever after that. And as long as it meets this disfavored exception, that's enough in a criminal case. And frankly, I would disagree with that position. I think that there is also some suggestion in Crawford that, or some reason why they did not overrule Roberts insofar as non-testimonial evidence is concerned. One of the previous cases that the court that the U.S. Supreme Court decided was Idaho versus Wright, which involved a statement to, I believe, a sex abuse victim's statement to a pediatrician. The court never mentioned that it was overruling that decision. And I assume it's still good law in that case. And there's only one of two ways that it could be good law. Either that statement to the pediatrician was considered testimonial under Crawford, or if it wasn't testimonial, then Roberts still applied, because in that decision they used Roberts to find that the admission of the statement violated Wright's confrontation rights. They didn't overrule Wright. And so I think we have to assume that statement to the pediatrician was either testimonial, or that Roberts still applies to non-testimonial hearsay.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Gregory M. Weber, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Weber.
Good morning, Chief Justice, members of the court. The state is asking for three principal holdings today. First, that the circuit court properly exercised its discretion in admitting Stamps' statement as a statement of recent perception. Second, that the statement was non-testimonial, as that term is used in Crawford, and that its admission did not violate the Confrontation Clause. And third, that Manuel suffered no prejudice from the manner in which the jury learned of Stamps' criminal character. That's the Trowitzki argument, which I suspect is probably going to fall out of the discussion today in favor of our discussion of Crawford and the evidentiary issue.
Counsel, why isn't this testimonial?
Two reasons, at least. The first is that there really is no comparison between the statement that was made here, the type of statement that was made here, and the civil law violations that Crawford focused on. Courts and commentators, and I'm sure Mr. Phillips and I have probably read more cases and law reviews in the last month, they seem to be breaking in one of two ways in analyzing statements as to whether or not they're testimonial. The first is a comparison of the statement at issue with the civil law practices that are described in Crawford. The court will compare the pro-offered statement against the types of ex parte affidavits, the types of ex parte statements that the Crawford court focused on, and depending on that comparison, saying it either is or is not testimonial. The second focus is the one that I suspect Mr. Phillips favors, and that is looking at the intent of the declarant, what the reasonable expectations of the declarant would be, whether or not that statement would be used for testimony at a later trial or used in evidence at a later trial. They seem to be breaking in one of two ways.
So it's the intent at the time the statement's made?
Yes. Under either of those characterizations, I think this statement is non-testimonial. It bears absolutely no resemblance to the types of civil law statements, the types of civil law evidence that the Crawford court focused on. And frankly, there's no indication in this record that Stamps made this statement with the expectation or the understanding that it would be used
in future litigation. The most likely scenario under the...
Robert, let me interrupt you right there. When I look at this situation, it doesn't seem to me, at least, to be far-fetched to conclude that Stamps knew that since someone had been shot, that there was likely to be someday a criminal trial, and that he certainly didn't want his girlfriend or anybody else thinking that he had anything to do with it. So doesn't that fall within this idea that, that he could anticipate that it might be later used at a trial?
We don't know for sure what his expectations were. We have to draw inferences from the record. It seems to me at least as reasonable an inference that he told her this for one of two reasons, to either share the burden of what must have been an emotional event. It's not unreasonable for people to do that with significant others, with lovers, with wives, with spouses. Or secondly, to explain to her, to drive home the point, that they needed to leave, that they needed to leave their residence, stay in a hotel for a few days. Neither of those explanations required him to have any anticipation that his statement would be used in litigation. Most of us, when we confide in family members, in close friends, we do that with the expectation that our confidences will be kept.
So your approach would be that those are much more reasonable inferences to draw from the actual evidence than the inference that Mr. Phillips might want us to draw.
Yes, Justice Crooks, and I think the cases that we cite on brief support that proposition as well. There are...
Counsel, you had said that you were had read aplenty all the law or many of the law review articles and the cases that have come down, and you've changed the prescription on your eyeglasses as a result of that,
yes.
I understand. Seems to me, and I haven't, but I've read a number of them, and it seems to me that the, some of the most recent ones, and they're cited in Mr. Phillips' brief, go with the third test, that Friedman, who's considered one of the top, if not the top, expert in the country on this issue, goes with the third test in terms of how you define testimonial. What's wrong, if anything, with the third test?
It's broad. As this Court is seeing, we're struggling right now with trying to discern the reasonable expectations of a person that was not heard from in the litigation, directly heard from in the litigation. And I concede that Professor Friedman is a strong advocate of that third position. There are other positions that are arising in law review journals. We have a number of prosecutors who are arguing that certain categories of hearsay, excited utterances in particular, ought to be deemed non-testimonial without any kind of individualized evaluation, simply because if you make a truly excited utterance, you're making it not in anticipation of litigation, you're making it as a response to what you're seeing contemporaneously or very close in time.
We have, if I recall, the Second Circuit, the Fourth Circuit, the Sixth Circuit, all going with the third test. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. As an aside, I read on Professor Friedman's web blog this morning that the Ninth Circuit has broken with the other circuits in the area of retroactive application of Crawford. So assuming that there isn't an en banc review of that decision that brings the Ninth in on with the rest of the circuits on retroactivity, the U.S. Supreme Court may see Crawford coming back again. Now, whether they would reach the substantive question of what is a testimonial statement or not, who can say? But we can be hopeful. In Crawford, the Supreme Court said at page 1363 of the decision, the 124 Supreme Court version, they said that the principal evil at which the Confrontation Clause was directed was the civil law mode of criminal procedure, and particularly its use of ex parte examinations as evidence against the accused. And most recently, one of the more recent state decisions, which I think is cited in the brief, out of the Oregon Supreme Court, State versus Mack, they say as well,
The primary focus in Crawford was on the method by which government officials elicited out-of-court statements for use in criminal trials, not on the declarant's intent or purpose in making the statement. So if we're struggling for an analytical framework here to evaluate hearsay as testimonial or non-testimonial, it seems to me that a primary question that this Court should ask is whether the statement bears any kind of resemblance to the civil law abuses that the Confrontation Clause targeted. And if you focus on that, Stamps' statement is plainly non-testimonial. The facts of the case don't remotely resemble the abusive civil law practices that the Crawford Court focused on. Indeed, the government played no direct or indirect role in producing this statement. Stamps made his statement in a private conversation to a private individual not associated with the government, and in truth with no apparent expectation that it would be conveyed to police or prosecutors. There was no structured police questioning. In this case, there was no police questioning at all. The circumstances here are terribly dissimilar.
But how does he get to try to cross-examine this statement, which is the foundation of the right of confrontation, when there's no one here?
If it's not testimonial hearsay,
then he has no right of confrontation.
I believe that's correct. I believe that conclusion.
The argument is somewhat circular, don't you think?
I don't.
Well, I mean, you're going to use it to accuse him in trial, but you're saying it's non-testimonial because of the way in which it was developed or the way in which it was obtained, but that doesn't really change the content of it or its force when it comes into trial.
Well, if you focus on the Supreme Court's interpretation of what the Confrontation Clause was intended to accomplish, the Supreme Court said that not all hearsay will implicate Confrontation Clause concerns, even hearsay that may have an accusatory aspect to it. If it falls outside of the testimonial hearsay boundaries, then the Confrontation Clause is not implicated. States individually, I think, can choose to, in their rules of evidence, adopt types of protections or provisions that serve whatever goals the state wants to have served in the presentation of evidence.
But doesn't that rule change post-Crawford? I mean, I understand the issue is not before the court because it wasn't presented that way. But I can envision a situation where you have non-hearsay by definition, such as a prior inconsistent statement, that may nevertheless be testimonial. So how do you, I don't see the hearsay and the confrontation clauses being equating with each other. I see them as two different things. And post-Crawford, I'm not sure where that leaves us.
I'm not sure. Can you give me an
example? For example, an argument from this case that was not briefed and is not before us and will not be, I'm assuming will not be decided by us, I might be wrong, is the fact that you have a statement from the girlfriend to the police. Now, that statement, I believe under Vogel, is non-hearsay.
Right.
But it still may be arguably testimonial. Is Crawford implicated?
I have to think about that.
I think we all have to think about that. But that's the point. And that's why I raised the issue of the prior cases pre-OLB Roberts of how at least the courts historically have always interpreted that while there's some overlap, there is a difference between hearsay and confrontation, and they are not the same thing.
I don't know what has happened to the body of Confrontation Clause jurisprudence that comes after the medieval England period and before Crawford. I'm not sure about the viability of many aspects of that body of law. And that's an issue, frankly, that I have to think about.
Right. And I understand it's not quite before us. But I want to be careful about going down that path that if we're not dealing with hearsay, confrontation is not implicated. Because I don't know that that's necessarily correct.
The individual, I think I'm right in saying that post-Crawford, the individual states could, in the context of their own rulemaking, develop, in essence, a series of confrontation clause-like protections as part of their own state law jurisprudence, not necessarily derived from the federal constitutional prohibition or protection of confrontation out of state law jurisprudence, which kind of ties into what happens to Ohio versus Roberts under Wisconsin law post-Crawford. It seems to me that the Supreme Court in Crawford left open the possibility for states to say, we choose only to deal with non-testimonial hearsay under our state rules of evidence. I think that is a legitimate conclusion that could be drawn from Crawford the way that it was written. Admittedly, the Supreme Court did not expressly overrule Ohio versus Roberts. I think an argument can be made that it has lost all of its vitality in light of what the United States Supreme Court is telling us is the test for testimonial hearsay. I appreciate the concern that the Court of Appeals had in this case in deciding it wanted to proceed with an abundance of caution in evaluating the admissibility of the evidence under Ohio versus Roberts, and we would certainly concur in the Court of Appeals' assessment of the admissibility of the evidence under Ohio versus Roberts. But as I say, I think that this Court could construe Crawford to stand for the proposition that non-testimonial hearsay should be deemed admissible or inadmissible simply by applying the Wisconsin rules of evidence.
One of my concerns is this particular hearsay exception. And from my perspective, most of the commentators look with great disfavor on this particular hearsay exception. As you know, when the Federal Rules Advisory Committee had introduced this into the federal rules, that they kicked it out. They declined to adopt it because there wasn't enough indicia of reliability in this proffered hearsay exception. Undaunted, Wisconsin proceeded forward. And Wisconsin was one of a handful of jurisdictions that said, we think it's going to be good enough, even though it's not in the federal rules. Of those jurisdictions, one only applies it in civil, not criminal cases, because of concern of indicia of reliability. Another passed it, like Wisconsin, but has since repealed it. So I think there might be three of us left that still have this, you know, and it's been rejected because there isn't sufficient indicia of reliability. And so when dealing with this particular exception, which has a very unique history in Wisconsin, I get nervous. And then when you say, okay, you can get it in under our rules of evidence, and you know, there's no right because it's sufficiently reliable and it can be used to really cause great damage in a trial, and yet it's not necessarily subject to any cross-examination whatsoever. Witness unavailable is the heading of the exception. Don't we have to proceed with an abundance of caution, especially with this hearsay exception?
Well, and I think the Circuit Court in this case and the Court of Appeals reviewing that decision did proceed in an abundance of caution, taking great pains to evaluate the reliability of this statement, the likely reliability of the statement. Statements of recent perception, my experience has been that it is not often used as a mechanism to admit hearsay testimony in criminal trials. Far more often that you would see something offered as an excited utterance or some other variation.
Very, in fact, more firmly rooted hearsay exception. This, but, you know. I note in paragraph 14 of the Court of Appeals opinion, it seems to me the linchpin for them, it says, citing Stevens, noting that corroboration is the key to reliability of a statement coming under this exception. That's paragraph 14 right of the Court of Appeals opinion. And then they analyze and say, here, there is corroboration. But that, for them, that would seem to me to be the linchpin in reliability, citing Stevens, that corroboration was the key in admitting it. Do you interpret that differently?
Yes, and I wouldn't dispute that. And again, a level of review, a level of appellate review of the circuit court decision found this particular statement to be sufficiently trustworthy to justify its admission under this particular exception to the hearsay rule.
Could you argue that this was, that Stamp's statement was an excited utterance?
I think they had concerns about the amount of time that had passed between the making, or between the event and the making of the statement. I, in truth, don't know if they offered it as an excited utterance or not. I know it was admitted as a statement of recent perception. In certain classes of cases, primarily kid cases, child maltreatment prosecutions, they're willing to broaden out the time period beyond a few moments to hours and, in some cases, even days. My preference is always to answer the court's questions.
I do have one. I want to go back to the three examples of testimonial that are mentioned in Crawford at page 1364. And maybe I'm misunderstanding Crawford, so I'm looking for help. When I see the three different formulations, I know the defense has argued that we should adopt the third formulation. I'm not sure which one you are arguing that we adopt, but I guess my question is there anything inconsistent between the three? Or is there any reason why we shouldn't adopt all three?
If you accept the proposition that each individual statement should be analyzed to determine whether or not it's testimonial hearsay or non-testimonial, if you reject the idea of a categorical determination, then I would suspect that since the Supreme Court did not adopt a specific formulation, they are at least tacitly endorsing an evaluation of individual statements taking into account aspects of all three. And I think that the decisions that I've read in large part have done that. They will compare the statement at issue with the civil law abuses and the Marianist statutes. They will compare it to the types of extrajudicial statements that I think Justice Thomas had noted in an earlier decision, and that was engrafted into Crawford. And they will look at whether an individual made a statement under circumstances which would lead somebody objectively to believe that the statement would be available for later use at a trial. I see no fundamental problem with incorporating all three of those formulations in an individual analysis. I think
we don't have to lock ourselves into one definition here today.
If the United States Supreme Court didn't do it, I don't think you guys have to do it either.
Well, it's not that they didn't do it, as I understand the Crawford opinion. It's that, hey, in Crawford, you didn't need to because you're dealing with clearly testimonial evidence. And so they didn't have to come to grips with what the definition was.
Would that they had.
Mm-hmm.
Well, which one includes the most evidence?
Probably the third.
Third. So if you just take the first level, less is testimonial, therefore less is automatically excluded. Isn't that what happens under Crawford? If it's testimonial, you're out. Okay. So, and under the second, I'm assuming it's a little broader than the first, and the third is the broadest. That is, it will encompass most. Now, under the third, doesn't it by definition include the first two? If you adopt the third definition, wouldn't a preliminary hearing testimony fall under three?
I think it would. I think most people who gave ex parte affidavits or statements in the context of a case would expect that their work would be, or their statements would be, used at a trial. Certainly, if it's coming from some sort of formalized testimonial materials that implies a prior trial, you would expect that it would be used.
What I'm getting at is, does it make sense to adopt all three if the first two are by definition included in the third. I don't know. I didn't think it through. And, you know, I'm sure somebody can think of an example that's covered in one, won't be covered in three.
I think some commentators and courts have looked at the Crawford decision and looked at that focus on the civil law abuses and have said, this is where we intend to place our scrutiny. Some courts have noted that that the third standard was one that was proposed by an amicus in the case, and that the Supreme Court did not expressly adopt it or any of the other three to the exclusion of the others.
Which amicus? Is it prosecution or defense?
Again, please.
The amicus, prosecution or defense?
Oh, chief. Defense attorneys. It was NACTL, I believe.
Right. It's because it covers more material, which would exclude it from, automatically exclude it from evidence.
Yeah. Well, if you adopt, and I think I cited this law review in the brief, if you adopt the third standard, I wonder what would happen to statements made by young children to law enforcement officers, out-of-court statements accusing someone of a sexual assault. What I'm driving at is one of the commentators, and I think I cited it in the brief, felt that if you adopted that third characterization flat out, that many statements made by children who don't have a full understanding of the legal consequences or implications of what they're saying, that those statements might categorically be described as not testimonial, I mean, which is why we wrestle, I think, with these different formulations.
Yeah, but you'd get that in under one of the other cases, or you'd exclude it under one of the other cases. Maybe not. Maybe the cases that say you got to eyeball the person no longer are in existence. I mean, here you have a child who can testify, assuming that you don't want to put them on the stand, right?
It is definitely going to change the way that certain classes of cases are prosecuted. Domestic violence cases, child abuse cases, where so much of the evidence comes in the form of exceptions to the hearsay rule, hearsay statements made by children, statements made by domestic violence victims. And you will see that as you research your decision in this case. There's considerable commentary about how this decision is going to affect those prosecutions.
So the Supreme Court has really, in your opinion, made a very dramatic change in its interpretation of the Confrontation Clause that dramatically affects the trail of the case.
I think that's a fair characterization. You read a lot of the hyperbolic descriptions of Crawford in the different cases and in the different law review articles. I tend to agree. It was a profound change.
But if we were to adopt your position, that profound change actually would benefit the state with respect to non-testimonial evidence, would it not?
And there are commentators who have said that this really is a prosecutor's decision. If you win the battle over whether it's testimonial or not testimonial.
Sure, because it gets more evidence in. I mean, maybe you'd only have to get to the hearsay, not Ohio v. Roberts.
Not Ohio versus Roberts.
Mr. Weber, it's my understanding that your third position, that when you started out telling us about what you wanted here, your third position was basically that even if we ruled against you on number one and said that the circuit court did not properly exercise its discretion at admission, or if we ruled against you in regard to number two and thought that this was testimonial, that still there was no prejudice to the defendant. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So it's really a harmless error argument.
Thank you for waiting for the last 5 minutes before you raise your
I didn't want to get into the depth of it.
I've heard recently that it's a work in process.
Could be.
We've made our harmless error argument on brief based on an analysis under Harvey Nader. Our position basically is that the evidence was overwhelming, connected to the identification by the victim of the shooter.
Okay.
And also to circumstantial evidence having to do with footprints and other things.
Physical evidence derived on scene, yes.
Maybe we don't even have to decide the substantive issue. Just say, regardless of everything, it's just harmless error. That would be easy, maybe.
That'd be true evidence testimonial.
You could certainly do that if four of you agree on what the harmless error test is.
You think you could win this even under Chapman, though, right?
I'm
sorry? You think you could win this case even under Chapman, right?
Let me turn your attention to statutory interpretation and the rules regarding statutory interpretation. Would you like to wade into that?
Thank you so much.
I just want to help.
It's been a long week.
For us all.
If there are no other questions, I thank the court for its consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Weber. Mr. Phillips.
Let me start with my position on adopting one of the formulations for testimonial. I think that the third formulation is the broadest. It may not, there's one situation that I can conceive that it may not encompass something that might be covered under one of the first two, and that is if a witness or a suspect is speaking to an undercover officer and is being interrogated by that officer. That might qualify as a formal interrogation, but the witness may not realize it, may not reasonably expect that the statement would be used. But I think under Crawford that would have to be considered testimonial. I have no problem if the court wanted to say if a statement meets any of the three formulations, then it's testimonial. But I think, just for shorthand purposes, the third formulation is the best and is the broadest of the three. And I think getting to the point of a child speaking to an interrogator, I think most of the law review articles, in fact, Professor Friedman's point in his law review article is that you don't look at it from the standpoint, it's an objective test. But you don't look at it from the standpoint of an objective, say, four-year-old. You look at it from the standpoint of an objective witness more generally, a witness speaking to a child protective services worker or speaking to a police officer or so forth, regardless of age, would probably figure that allegations of sexual abuse, for instance, would be available for use at a later trial. So that's the objective evaluation that would have to be made.
Run that by me again. So you are saying they would or they would not be available for use? Because it seems to me that if we adopt the test you're asking us to adopt, that the statements that the child makes to the social worker are going to be problematic.
Yeah, I think most people, when speaking to a social worker and making specific allegations of sexual abuse, would assume that those allegations would be passed on to the authorities.
Yeah, I think in this day and age, when they're made to anybody, you would think they're going to be passed on, right? I mean, what about the child telling his preschool teacher?
Preschool teacher is maybe another level removed from that. The more official the person, I suppose, the more likely it is the statement would be available for later use.
So then you're taking it from the standpoint of the person who is getting the statement, not the person who is giving the statement.
That's a difficult question. In the interrogation aspect, that's a little different than, frankly, I don't know how to answer that.
Okay.
And we don't have interrogation here, so I haven't had to confront that, but whether it's the intent of the interrogator or the interrogatee, I think is a difficult question.
And I think that's the difficulty in adopting just one of the prongs here.
That may be. But I think interrogation, any formal interrogation, would have to meet the definition of testimonial. I wanted to answer your question about Rhodes's statement to the police. I think that statement is subject to confrontation analysis, that statement clearly was testimonial. She was interrogated by the police, but because she testified at trial, the confrontation clause isn't implicated, and that's why I didn't raise any confrontation objection to that.
Except she was declared unavailable.
Well, she wasn't declared unavailable, but she was...
Oh, I thought she was declared unavailable.
No, she testified.
I know she was there. But the circuit court judge declared her unavailable because she didn't have a recollection. She couldn't remember, and then employed the inconsistent statement, non-hearsay.
I don't know if it's, strictly speaking, an unavailability determination or if it's just construed to be a bad faith lack of recollection, which is what Lenarczyk requires for the statement to be considered inconsistent.
But that deals with the hearsay issue. Not necessarily the confrontation.
No, I'm talking about Rhodes's bad faith in not recalling what Stamps had told
him. I mean, but before you get to recent perception, you have to be unavailable. Witness unavailable.
The witness, of course, is Stamps, not Rhodes. So they didn't have to find that Rhodes was unavailable.
Yeah, I know. I guess we were talking about the testimony with regard to the girlfriend, and as an aside. We won't go into it, but I think it poses some real problems.
Maybe I'm a little naive on this, but I think the harmless error test of Nader and Chapman can be reconciled, particularly if the court focuses on the language in Nader says not just that a rational juror could have convicted the defendant without this evidence, but that it's clear beyond a reasonable doubt that the rational juror would have done so. So if you consider the logic of that, what the court is really saying is it irrational that a jury, when faced with only the evidence that it should have considered, it's irrational to think that the jury could have acquitted the defendant under these circumstances. And I would submit that it is not irrational, that there were significant problems with Adams's identification, with his credibility, with his opportunity to see who shot him, and with his potential bias in the case. And that's why the state did not rely solely on Adams's identification. And that's why Stamps's statement was so critical to the prosecution's case. Basically, it just boils down to this, is that there were two people that accused Mr. Manuel of this shooting, and only one of them appeared in court, and only one of them was ever cross-examined, and only one of them was ever seen by the jury. And that's what this case is all about. So unless the court has other questions, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips, and thank you, Mr. Weber. As we explore the ramifications of the Crawford case, thank goodness I think we don't have to explore the ramifications of Blakely, at least at the moment. So with that, we end our hearing on 03-113 CR, State versus Manuel, and we are in recess until 1:30 when we hear our third case.